This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape episode. I'm Jonathan London, your host. And this episode of Geekscape, we're going to be doing a deep dive on Dave Stevens, who is the creator of The Rocketeer. The Rocketeer film by Joe Johnson is one of the reasons that I got back into comic books as a teenager. I was past my adolescence at that point. I was probably 11, 12, 13. And seeing The Rocketeer on the big screen and being a big fan of the Ninja Turtles and all that post-Tim Burton Batman stuff on the big screen really got me back into comic book stores. And I've been in comic book stores ever since. Really, Dave Stevens and The Rocketeer play a big role in that. In this episode, I got to sit down with Kelvin Mao and Rob Chatlin. They've put together this brand new documentary all about Dave Stevens. It's called Dave Stevens Drawn to Perfection. And they have a Kickstarter that's ending as soon as I put this episode up. It ends on the 2nd, so I'm going to put this episode up on December 1st. And if you go to Kickstarter and search for The Rocketeer or Dave Stevens, you're going to find the Kickstarter. They're so well past their goal on this one. They were looking for 15 grand to put together the film and release it on Blu-ray. They're over 80 grand right now. That just shows you how much people love The Rocketeer. If you're not familiar with Dave Stevens or The Rocketeer, which sounds insane to me if you're a pop culture fan. Please listen to this episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it. I learned a lot. Dave Stevens, I describe as an enigma. He's a creator whose body of work before he passed away at a young age influenced a lot of people, was influenced by a lot of people, and really left a pretty indelible mark on comics. And we talk a lot about them in the next hour. So be ready to get educated. I think this is a really fun episode, a great conversation, and share it with your friends if you learn something. Hey, Geekscapists, I'm here with my good friends, Kelvin Mao and Rob Chatlin. They have a brand new movie out this week. It's called Dave Stevens Drawn to Perfection. And I hope you all are familiar with Dave Stevens. He's the artist creator of The Rocketeer, but he's responsible for so much more. And he's really a bit of an enigma still, in a sense, when it comes to the comic book community, because his body of work is from, it really existed over a short period of time when you think about some of the luminaries of comics. And this documentary, having watched it and of course knowing about Dave Stevens' career since I got into comics, I think he deserves a place among a lot of those people who established the art form and brought it to levels that we appreciate today. I mean, obviously, Geekscapists comics are everywhere. We see them on the big screen. They are absolutely a part of our cultural zeitgeist. And I think Dave Stevens deserves a place in there. Kelvin directed the movie. Robert, you helped produce it along with Kelvin and edited it. Let's get into it. What was your process of putting this film together and getting involved?
It was all Rob's fault, actually. I'm not sure if you remember it the same way. You know, this project was like a child of the pandemic, as you know, a lot of people were sitting around for a long time, and I think it was late fall of 2020, and we'd all been working on little film projects, you know, separately, you know, like the three of us, and Rob had just finished doing another documentary on Scotch malt whiskey that was supposed to come out in April in Scotland, but of course, April in 2020, no one did anything anywhere. So, you know, he's like, what about doing another project? So it was actually him that brought it, came up with the idea. So Rob, tell us your process, because I don't know.
From my recollection, we were playing poker over Zoom, because everything was Zoom that time. And just, you know, the game got boring, or I had bad cards, most likely. And the idea came, hey, let's do this documentary on Dave. I knew that Kelvin was friends with Dave towards the end of his life, and it seemed like a great idea. So we talked about it, did a little research, found out there's nothing else out there, and we all agreed on it. It's like, hey, this is great, and we went forward. So we had, you know, 6 months basically of pandemic pre-production to do research and to plan and to arrange our interviews and get a crew together and build our team and get everyone on board with our passion project, until we were able to start production in April, once, you know, vaccines were out and everyone was starting to open up again.
So this is a movie that really has come apart, come together in like the last 18 months, if any. I mean, production-wise, like you had your six months of pre-production. That was 2 years ago. You started that, and then come April 2021, if I heard that correctly, y'all started putting interviews together.
That's right. April 2021 was our first interview. We were going to do one in December as a test, but previous December, our interviewee got ill, not with COVID, but and then that sort of basically told us, hey, look, let's just try and get our ducks in a row and get, you know, and where, you know, it's not like it was a little easier, you know, and wait until it's a little bit less stressful to all involved, you know, to start shooting.
And the movie comes out this week. So, I mean, that is 18 months after y'all started production for the most part. And that's a pretty aggressive schedule when it comes to documentaries. Usually documentaries, because of the amount of footage and just the amount of travel to get the footage and the scheduling with, you know, there's not like a production window, like a traditional fictional production. You stretch this thing out over months and availability. That's pretty aggressive, guys. Was there a date you were hoping to hit with this December 2nd release?
Yes. Not with the second specifically, but you know, from the beginning, it was sort of baked into the 1990 or 2022 is the 40th anniversary of the Rocketeer's creation, and so right in the beginning, we're like, okay, let's try, and we need to do have a deadline, just, you know, to keep driving us forward, something to aim forward. So, you know, because we're doing this on weekends and stuff. And so that was always in our mind. And you know, so our goal was actually to screen some version of it at San Diego Comic-Con this year, which did work. And then, you know, as it turns out, there's a lot to involve with releasing a film that has nothing to do with making it. So after that, we found that out, you know, the hard way. So after the film was actually finished, we were just scrambling. Let's try and have this be released sometime in the calendar year so that we can kind of keep that, you know, goal in mind and try to fulfill that part of our original brief. So
it seems amazing to me that what you just said, that this is the 40th anniversary of Dave's, I guess, signature creation. He created a lot of things over the course of his career, and the fact that it's been 40 years since the creation of the Rocketeer is both incredible, but it also a bit of a testament to how powerful that character was, because 40 years was 1982, and there was a film on the big screen within, what, 10 years of the character's creation. I credit that late 80s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Tim Burton, Batman-inspired influx of fandom as getting me into comics as a 10-year-old. And The Rocketeer was a big part of that. Going to see The Rocketeer with my father and my brothers was a magical experience. I think it's one of my favorite Joe Johnston movies. He's in the documentary Geekscapist. He talks a bit about the production of that film. I don't remember the film being a box office kind of disappointment as it was kind of depicted a little bit. I love the movie. I know that it's gained fans in the years since, but the documentary says that after all the work and struggle in going from studio to studio to try and get a Rocketeer film up on the big screen, it underperformed. Did that hurt the legacy of the Rocketeer or Dave's fire to keep working on the project?
I think, go ahead, Galvin.
No, go ahead, Robbie. You take this one.
You know, the movie had the high expectations that coming off of Batman that made bank. Disney thought they had their own version of it and probably a franchise opportunity. And for whatever reason, it just didn't connect at that time. Dave, naturally soured more on Hollywood and the process of making films than the actual character and everything. But as in the film, Danny Bilson, the co-screenwriter, says that it has grown over time. It's found its audience later in life, and people appreciate it now. And throughout our filmmaking process, a lot of people we talked to said, oh, yeah, I love that movie that influenced me, that really had a special impact on my childhood. And that's how they all jumped on our bandwagon because of the film. So in that case, it's a victory and it's a success.
I mean, there's something interesting about The Rocketeer as a period piece. To me, The Rocketeer is, being a period piece is sort of baked into the concept of what it is. And having made a movie, Joe Johnston having made this movie in 1991, a lot of movies from the time period or any time period are dated because they're set in that time period. But making something that's set in the 30s, I think has given the movie a timelessness to it, where it still holds up. None of that stuff feels hokey. There's no music that's too grounded in that period of time. And I think that really sort of helps it. And I think that helps the comic book too, that the comic book ages quite well because it's always set in this time period that, is a kind of a classic vintage period, no matter when you could have read this thing. Even in 82, it feels the same way as it does in 2022. So,
and what's great, and I think you did a really great job, guys, on depicting this in the documentary and really nailing this, is that Dave Stevens, Geekscapist, if you're not familiar with Dave Stevens, then I've failed in my job as the host of this podcast. Because
you're redeeming yourself, so thank you.
I meant what I said earlier, that and you said this in the documentary, that Dave Stevens came out of the 1970s. San Diego Comic-Con was starting at that time. He was in those early cons. He was part, his wife, that he met at the San Diego convention, was an early cosplayer. Now cosplay is big, but he was at the crest of the wave that became the 80s, that became the 90s, that became where we are now. And even though he was contemporaries of people like Bernie Wrightson and some amazing artists during the 70s, and he understudied people like Jack Kirby and these legends from the 40s, 50s, 60s that were part of, but there's photos of him with Bob Kane, etc., in the documentary. He had influences that were almost similar to Norman Rockwell in depicting that era that you talk about, that 1930s American dream era. And that also lends itself to his fascination with Betty Page, his love of Betty Page, which turned into an in-person relationship later on with an elderly Betty Page. I think that adds to the timelessness. What were some of the things that you discovered when you think about Dave Stevens? And as sort of a man out of time, is that correct? Would you say that?
Yes, I used to always joke with Dave himself and say that you were nostalgic for your parents' childhood, because he never saw that time period. But, he used to say that, like, where he grew up, in Portland, in Idaho, and also in Southern California, that there were remnants of those time periods, still people's houses, the same music was being played. And so he got to see like sort of the trailing end of that being, growing up in the mid 50s.
Yeah, he was born in 1955.
Right. So that stuff really imprinted on him. And so it really does guide all of his aesthetic, from the cars to the airplanes. He really loved that era design. And that's what appealed to him. And then once cars and airplanes started to look different, I think that he started to lose interest. I don't know that he ever could have done a story that was set in completely contemporary with just without those trappings. And that's why I think, like you said, the Rocketeer is sort of like the period part of it is baked in to it. And the nostalgia for, you know, obviously an idealized, you know, the best of, you know, that period of time.
And Kelvin, you knew Dave later in his life. How did you meet Dave?
Well, I actually met Dave in 1992. I moved out to LA in 92. It was my first San Diego Comic-Con, which I had an unbroken streak of going to the show until this last convention. But
this past year?
The first time. Yeah. No, oh. Unfortunately, I got COVID right before the show.
I'll tell you, Kelvin, I'm about to put in for rooms we've been exhibitors for the last 11, 12 years. And so, you know, we should be promoting your documentary there next summer.
Right, today's the day. I think my wife is doing the same thing.
Yeah, tomorrow morning the exhibitor rooms open up. It'd be fun to have you shake some hands with some Geekscapists if they hear interview to come put faces with the names and the voices.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but in 92,
that's all right.
I met Comic-Con.
Yes, I met him at the San Diego Comic-Con like quite early on, like when I first moved out here, but didn't become friends with him until around 1999. I started collecting original comic book art a year or two into going to San Diego and discovering it there.
Were you intimidated by Dave?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Dave had this reputation in that sort of world of artists. And I mean, he was a real, you know, artist. Other artists looked up to this person. And, you know, even if they were not necessarily much younger than him.
But so he was such a perfectionist that his artwork was...
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Continue.
So you know, like you know, at some point, I got the gumption to try and I'd like to own a piece of Dave Stevens' artwork. And a friend of his introduced us in San Diego or WonderCon in like 1999-ish, somewhere around there, and probably right around the time that he became ill. But I didn't know this for like 2 or 3 years. We had an interesting relationship in that respect. I think at one point he just acknowledged that I must know. And at some point I realized, oh, he's not hiding it anymore. So we would never talk about it really, but like there was a sort of, unspoken understanding, but well, the people in the documentary, the people that are cast are, many of them knew him from, you know, the '70s and much longer and much, much better than I did. So
his relationships are something that I think are really interesting, and not just his romantic relationships, but the level of perfectionism that he brought to his work. And Geekscapists, please, if you're listening to this, be Googling, be searching out Dave Stevens' artwork. There's just a level to it that you don't find often in comics, maybe because of the time it takes to make a comic book. Comic books are a monthly title and they come out every month. So artists have to work very quickly. We've had Rob Liefeld talk on this podcast about how he designed Deadpool, and it's basically Spider-Man without all the webs he had to draw to draw Spider-Man so that he could draw Deadpool and make deadlines very quickly. And that's the essence of Deadpool's design. And so as comics artists are trying to work very quickly, Dave was somebody who was a perfectionist and would painstakingly spend a lot of time, sometimes 6 to 10 times as long as it took other artists. And although a lot of places liked the quality of the end result, the deadlines were always missed. And that level of perfectionism, did he hold his friends and his relationships to that high regard? It seemed like that tripped them up a bit in his romantic relationships.
He was not, in many ways, he was not a flexible human being. And I got to experience this. And, you know, My father, you know, also passed away of a kind of cancer. So like people get older and they're very inflexible, you know what I mean? Like, and they, especially if they're put in a situation where, you know, they're really stressed or, you know, it's unfamiliar territory. And so, you know, it's hard for me to say. We didn't have the kind of relationship where we talked about his romantic relationships. I would see people sort of flit in and out here and there, but it wasn't really the nature of what, to me, it's more just about Dave was an artist that like lived his aesthetic. That's something we discovered during the film, that there's a guy who was art directing himself even when people weren't watching. It was almost like he was living a movie and he was directing it, and he wanted it to be the way he wanted it to be. And so I'm sure his relationships sort of, you know, obviously it's with another person or more other people, a clash of the idea that you can control this sort of storybook, you know, perfectly curated, you know, art directed sensibility. You know, we did talk to obviously his ex wife Brink and some of his other some of his models who got to sort of see some of his relationships firsthand. So yeah, I think it was tough to have an ideal in your mind that you're going for all the time with artwork. And with his work, you know, he did do a lot of commercial artwork, which I think we touched upon. And that was sort of a lot of times his bread and butter and the rent money when he was really working on the comics as a side. And that's, I think, where he could kind of relax, that the job was something quick and singular and he would be done with it. It would never come up again. And then he could like let that sort of thing go. You know, I mean, if you're doing a wine ad for Gallo Wines or a toy design for Tomy, like I don't think that had the same kind of personal importance to him as the Rocketeer or a Betty Page drawing or anything like that.
But his Raiders story boards, doing the visualizations for Spielberg's Raiders, I mean, that is right up his alley. That stuff is almost, you know, that stuff is in the same sort of league is what he does in the Rocketeer. I mean, it's the same era. It's the same kind of tone. That stuff was incredible. And I did not know until I'd seen the documentary that Dave did storyboards and did some of the visuals for a lot of those Hollywood films. It's pretty incredible.
Well, we discovered a little bit about this. I mean, he could be driven. Rob, you want to tell the story? He could be driven to put more into his commercial work on occasion, but it had to be a very special situation.
And Raiders was one of them, I'm guessing.
Yes, Rob boxes
for him. it checked all the boxes he had. All right, I'm going to lose it. You tell it, Calvin. I'm not going to get this.
All right. Well, you know, it was the back and forth really that we found out about from I think it was Jeff Darrow and Bill Stout, that you know he was sort of caught between Steven Spielberg and George Lucas in terms of like. How to approach this. Steven Spielberg really loved the storyboards, and storyboards are generally supposed to be just enough to give you a direction. I mean, if you are a film director, a lot of times you just do it yourself. And if you're not an artist, it just looks like stick figures with camera moves and stuff. Just telling you just as a little journal of how you want this thing to go from a shooting, you know, camera work perspective. But you know, of course, Dave being Dave, you know, did these illustrations. They look like, you know, full-on illustrations are better than, you know, better than any comic book at the time anyway, except maybe the Rocketeer. But and then, you know, George Lucas is saying, well, hurry the heck up, you know, this isn't supposed to look like this. And so Spielberg loves them. Yes, yes, more and more. And then Lucas is sort of, you know, look with his eye on the clock. And so he's going a little crazy. But, you know, he's definitely Dave was definitely like a compulsive guy. He had to do it the way that he wanted it to be done. He wouldn't leave his desk, you know what I mean, until you'd have to really wrestle it away from him if he wasn't 100% satisfied, which I don't know how, if that ever happened. But and the same thing with the thriller storyboards. He was friends with Michael Jackson. I think, you know, Michael loved his artwork, and I think having that kind of relationship with the filmmaker, with the, you know, is what sort of charged him up to do, you know, go above and beyond what something like a storyboard would normally require.
And I got so excited watching this documentary when you just mentioned Jeff Darrow. And Jeff Darrow is somebody who has also done Hollywood visualizations and storyboards. He worked on the Matrix films. And talk about painstaking detail in his work. I love Jeff Darrow's artwork. It is my definition of a painstaking artist. The amount of, I mean, he draws every rock in the desert on some of these things, and phenomenal. And of course, Adam Hughes, whose depictions of his characters have a sense of that 1930s aesthetic as well. I love the way Adam Hughes draws and paints his characters. Was there anything that you discovered about Dave that you didn't know going into this documentary?
Well, I'm sure Rob discovered some things as
I was not as familiar because I did not have the friendship. I first discovered the Rocketeer, interestingly enough, when I moved to California in 91. One of the very first things I ever did in California, Los Angeles, was a test screening of the Rocketeer film. And it was unfinished, no effects, a lot of placeholders, and it was just sort of eye-opening to start this career. And then, of course, you see the finished product a year later, and it's like, okay. So that's how you connected those dots. But in terms of Dave's personal life and artistic life beyond the Rocketeer, it was all new to me. So I had this sense of, I was on the journey that the audience will be on, discovering these little things along the way, connecting the dots and realizing, oh, this influenced that to that, and that harkens back to these other things, and then jumps forward to the future. The one thing that I did not discover that we were unable to really find an answer to is how Dave first sort of fell in love with Betty Page. Where did he discover Betty? And that's something I think that's just lost to time as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And he probably enjoyed that.
And it was a revelation to me that he saw the Frazetta stuff in the same way. And yeah, I mean, I think y'all dance around it, but let's just face it. Our phases of puberty were responsible for so much of us getting into things like Frank Frazetta, Betty Page, the pinup stuff. I mean, we start discovering comics sort of in our adolescence, I guess. And we're kind of, you know, there's the newsprint stuff. There's the spinner rack when you're a kid. You're hanging out reading comics while your parents do the grocery shopping. But then as you start to get into puberty, some of the depictions of the women, that the way that Frazetta would do it, or the pinup artists, or Adam Hughes does it, I mean, that stuff is exciting to a kid. And I got to imagine that was the stuff that Dave got into and was like, oh my goodness, how can I recreate this? And not only that, but the sense of control that Dave had, not only on his own work, but sometimes it would work its way into relationships with other people. It seems like a tight wire act. And there's a portion of the film, and Geekscape is, I want you to watch the movie because I think Dave is incredibly fascinating. And there are parts of me that don't agree with him, like the perfectionism that he had in his relationships romantically. Like you hinted it, I don't know how definite this was, but what made him maybe a ladies' man was not only his confidence, but was anybody good enough for him? And there's a letter that he wrote to his ex-wife that's in the message that he writes to his ex-wife. In Geekscape, so I'm not going to spoil it here, but years after, you know, they remained friends, but years after their marriage, the letter, the message he writes is just painful. As Dave got sick and his mortality started becoming something that he's wrestling with, again, he had so much bravado, and I love the sequence where he's wearing a pirate shirt. Like, what else is bravado but somebody who thinks he can pull off a pirate shirt in public and still get women with it? You know, Kelvin, did he start thinking about the time that he had and in those relationships and things that he'd maybe done wrong or that he could have done better? I mean, it feels like somebody who's, like you said, art directing, constantly revising and critiquing the path that he'd taken.
Dave was a very compartmentalized person. I have this trait in common with him, something that we sort of understood. You have different groups of friends you sort of, you know, get together with to do whatever it is. You know what I mean? I had my friends I used to play hockey with. I had my comic book friends. They don't really cross paths. I just sort of go and do the thing. And Dave had that too. You know, one of the things that was most admirable about Dave at the end was his sort of insistence not to change how he lived his life when he got sick. I think for him, the true failure would have been to allow it to change him, change the parts of his approach to life that he, you know, were important and integral to him. And so did he think about regrets? Sure, absolutely. He was getting a little bit older. He was only 52, but you know, you get into those milestone years like Rob and I, you start to think about these things. But it was more like, you know, he meandered about a bit in the 90s, and he would say, oh, I wish I had I had buckled down and been more focused on a project, something else like The Rocketeer, to continue on that momentum. You know, a lot of people have this issue, you know, creators and stuff, of what to do next and how much time you spend trying to figure that out. We're going to have our own problem with that too. But like, I mean, to the end, the last time I saw Dave Stevens was 2 days before he passed away. He was up in Turlock. He was at like a Kaiser up there, and I drove up to help unpack some things because his mom had moved him up there, and they rented a little apartment for him to live in, you know, right near where they could keep an eye on him. And when I went to see him, he was completely himself. You know, he looked a little bit disheveled, but like, you know, personality wise, it was like any other day. And I guess I've been told by his mom that he wasn't doing so well. So it was a shock to go there and see him and have him just be the same old Dave. And for me to walk out of into the parking lot and be like, and say out loud, I don't think that's the last time I'm going to see him. So he sort of fooled me in that respect. Like, and that's something, like I said, he was a very unique person. So there's a lot of these things where I don't necessarily understand everything. Other than it was hard to get that on the screen too, trying to figure out this guy was really different. How do we project that out there and get that impression? And I hope that comes across, you know, that he was multifaceted, as well as very focused, you know?
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, I had troubles understanding him at times, and there were parts of Dave that I agreed with and parts of Dave that I didn't agree with, but there were always parts that I was inspired by, that I was moved by. And Robert, as the editor of this project, you had the lion's share of the job of crafting that sort of depiction. How much footage did y'all shoot? How many interviews did y'all do? How much of this documentary is on editing room hard drive somewhere?
You know, we shot 35 interviews, and Kelvin had detailed questions for everybody, and we probably came with over 80 hours of footage of live interviews, plus our archival footage of Dave and his entire body of artwork. And we started from that 80 hours. My first paper cut was about 4 hours when we assembled it. We watched that. They yelled at me. And then we cut that down to about 2.5. And then Kelvin and I really started to hone in. We knew we wanted to keep it around 100 minutes. And there's a lot we had to cut out. Some of those stories made it to bonus features that will be on the Blu-ray that we're releasing through our Kickstarter. But there's a lot of debate of what stays in, what comes out, what's the most important part. And we try to get touch on Dave's life and legacy at all the milestones, all the good and all the bad, and really didn't hide anything because we wanted to present the story.
Talk about the Kickstarter a bit, because this is a Kickstarter to put the print media in people's hands. And I got to say, like, one thing that I do appreciate is companies like IDW, who I think played a part in you putting the documentary together. They did such a great job of cataloging Dave's work. My first instance of going into a comic shop and finding the Rocketeer stuff was Dark Horse's prints of his work. And then IDW recently, in the last couple of years, put together the definitive stuff. And most recently, Geekscape, and I've talked about this on the podcast, there's a brand new Rocketeer book that IDW put 4 issues out of called The Great Race. And in the back, some of my familiarity going into the documentary was that there was a written history of Dave Stevens that they did as a backup bonus feature in these 4 issues. I hope it's
written by Calvin Mao.
And Calvin was a part of that. So I mean, trust me, when your publicist sent me this, I knew all about Calvin, at least from the written history of Dave that were in those IDW backup pieces. And I was fired up to watch this. Again, I find him to be an incredibly fascinating person. Talk about the Kickstarter and what that offers, maybe beyond something that the Geekscapists can download on digital and on demand on December 2nd.
Well, during the pandemic, I think for everyone, streaming became more of a thing. I mean, I think entertainment was moving in that direction anyway, not having physical media. But you know, we're geeks, we're comic book collectors, we're all kinds of collectors, and so we still like to have our physical media. And you know, this is one of those things where, like, I think today, if even a big documentary like Jiro Dreams of Sushi, something that's well known, I don't think would have gotten a Blu-ray release now. It would have come out on a streaming network exclusively, or, you know, bounced around, and then you could watch it whenever you wanted to on your Apple TV or Roku, whatever. And so for us, it was important to try and, like, let's have this thing that we can hold in our hands and at the end of the day. And the hope is that other people do too. So that was one of the main impetuses to do a Kickstarter. You know, the movie was done when we started the Kickstarter, so that we didn't need help with any completing anything, but it would have been nice just to, like, know that, like, hey, there's so many copies of this movie out there in people's hands, and it's a physical thing. And also, there's a comic book. The comic book is a very interesting thing. It came about during the actual shooting. We discovered when we interviewed Danny Bilson, which I think was our, I don't know, maybe fourth or fifth shoot day. That he and Paul DeMeo, who passed away tragically in 2018, had written this Rocketeer story that hadn't been published, a short story. And so then, Danny said, hey, could this ever be published? And then, of course, then the ball gets rolling. You tell Adam Hughes, hey, there's this thing. And he says, well, send it to me. And, you know, it's a different story. I think Danny felt like it was a little on the quiet side. And he wasn't sure what Adam loved it, immediately jumped on board. And then that sort of had the basis to do the rest of the comic book. I had written myself for Rocketeer Adventures years ago for Scott, a story that hadn't been used, because the Rocketeer Adventures ran for 2 4-issue arcs, and it was meant to do 3. But the artists were so late by the time Scott Dunbier came around to soliciting, I think, the third 4-issue miniseries, that they had to just sort of, you know, put it off until they could remedy that. So we just said, hey, let's try and get as many people as we can involved with this book that worked on the documentary. So there's 8 different people, 9 if you count Scott, who have a hand in making this comic book occur without credited. So to me, that's kind of a neat thing. It's just like the movie. Hey, let's get together with our 3 friends, make a movie. Hey, everyone making a movie, let's get together and make a comic book. So that was sort of our attitude. And, you know, there is that sort of emotional aspect of being able to get this final story out, written by the Rocketeer screenwriters, and you know, getting Adam Hughes, who is, you know, basically Dave's, you know, he was his protege. Dave was his mentor, you know, getting that person who hadn't drawn the Rocketeer for print before, which is amazing, to do this thing. And, you know, Adam works for Marvel Studios now. He's not a full-time comic book artist. So it was tough and it had to be something that he wanted to do and had enthusiasm for. And then we have Laura Martin, you know, who recolored all Dave's work for IDW. She's doing colored one of the stories. So that's the gist of it. Everything else that's in the Kickstarter, we sort of pattern after. We have a good friend, Jim Demonakos, who directed the Mignola documentary, who did a very good Kickstarter. So he helped advise us as to how to go about this thing that we had never done before. So
borrow from the best.
In the Kickstarter is live now. Is that what's going on with the Kickstarter? Like, talk to me about the Kickstarter. Because honestly, this is how I found out about the Kickstarter. Shane O'Hare, who is like the biggest Rocketeer fan, he does DJ gigs. He DJed a party we did with POW Entertainment at Comic-Con years ago. But his DJ name is The Last Rocketeer. He is a massive Rocketeer fan. And he said, oh my God, I got to donate to that Kickstarter. Talk to me about it, because honestly, that was the first I'd heard of the Kickstarter, and that's probably my failure with whatever online. I mean, I think y'all did a great job in the verbal written history and the great race. I think IDW did a great job promoting it. The Kickstarter, talk about, like, what if the Geekscapers can still jump in on that.
Rob, you want
to? Probably not. The Kickstarter ends Friday. This coming Friday, December 2nd. I'm not quite sure how your production schedule is.
I will put this up on Thursday. So, you Geekscapists, if you're listening to this live, and it hits the frying pan, you got 24 hours to cook on that Kickstarter. And I'll be sharing it on social as well, because this sounds pretty cool. And this is a different comic book through the Kickstarter than the one that IDW put out, correct? Is that what I'm hearing here, Kevin?
It's a one-shot. It's just a one-shot issue. It's essentially like one issue of the old Rocketeer Adventures that they put out back in 2011 or 2010, you know, with three stories, one by, you know, the team of Bilson DeMeo, one by myself, and one by our executive producer, Robert Windham. And then it's a pinup by Laura, Marie Laura Sinapo, who was in the movie, and is a big fan of Dave's and influenced by him indirectly. One of the things we wanted to do was have some people in the movie who felt his influence without having met him. I thought that was an interesting thing. We have, you know, Chris Donio in there, who's a specialty costumer for Marvel movies and stuff. So he, you know, we got a great little bonus clip of him coming up, which I won't spoil. But, you know, but the Kickstarter, this is all new to us. So it was a real kind of trial by fire with all the timings of the PR. And, you know, we knew that we wanted to have this Kickstarter lead up to, you know, Samuel Goldwyn's digital release, but then there was this window of like exclusivity for like, you know, dropping the trailer and making the announcements. So we had to sort of, you know, shoehorn that Kickstarter in, and we had just finished, and like I said, all the stuff in preparation for the release itself. There's all this paperwork and legal filings, and like I said,
you're finishing a movie while finishing it than actually producing. Y'all definitely leapt before you looked on this thing, and I mean, it is what it is. Like, that's how you get things done. You might have talked yourself out of it or staggered it a different way in an unsuccessful way had you looked into it. So this is just the way it goes, and that is incredible. I mean, having Adam Hughes drawn Rocketeer artwork is worth the investment enough, Geekscapists. If you're listening to this, hop on that Kickstarter right now. Just Google it and be a part of that, because that sounds incredible. And obviously, guys, when we get those Blu-rays or whatever y'all have left over from the Kickstarter, let's make sure to have a little bit of a corner for you guys at Comic-Con next year. It sounds like you have other booths as well that are probably supportive of this. It sounds like Comic-Con is part of the community that supports you guys. This is really, really awesome. And were you surprised by the reaction? I mean, obviously, The Rocketeer is not Marvel. It's not DC. It's not the stuff that's at the forefront of the barrage that we're getting of comic book material here in the last 15, 20 years. Were you pleasantly surprised when you started kind of finding your way to putting this movie together that there was a massive audience waiting for you? Is there a massive audience? Answer that one.
We have the confidence of the interviewees, the cast members, many of whom are, you know, artists of, you know, Dave's contemporaries or some, you know, a little bit older, you know, to every last one. When we approached them, you know, they were all very much, you know, if anyone deserves a documentary, it's Dave Stevens. So that was like a real great sort of positive reinforcement. And by the way, most of these people could anchor their own documentaries. That's one of the things we realized as we were shooting these people. Let's just keep shooting footage. Someone else might be able to use this stuff. You know, these artists and these people are getting older. So, you know, and then they were all, you know, sort of, you know, in the, you know, they're established in their own right. So that was sort of helped give us confidence and surprise. It's hard to say, you know, everything was so tentative in terms of the hoping part of it. You know, we were just determined to do this. And the reason the schedule worked out the way it is, because the three of us are all very enthusiastic and sort of hammer down guys. The pandemic did help with the working from home and no one knowing what we were doing, you know, during certain hours of the daytime. But, you know, yeah, it's been very gratifying. Surprising, I'm not sure surprising the right word, because you're hoping so much the whole time, you know what I mean? And so, you know, we're just so relieved that's not terrible, you know what I mean? Oh, we just tried to do our best. That's what we did, you know, and really
our goal was Dave may not have appreciated us making a documentary, but he would not have hated it. He would have understood that we were striving for his level of perfection, and we've come as close as we possibly could without killing each other. and he would have found fault with it, of course, but we think, you know, he would have been okay. Not bad, guys. Not bad. And I think everybody we approached when we said we're doing the Dave Stevens documentary jumped on board. Everyone contributed. We had people agreeing to interviews and submitting artwork and sending us photos and helping us out in every way they could. So everyone loved Dave enough to realize this had to be made. And Kelvin was the only person that could pull it all together through his relationship with Dave and his relationship in the comic art community. It was no other way to do it.
Well, Kelvin and Rob, we have this documentary. We have the comic book that's coming out of the Kickstarter. We have the work of IDW and preserving and putting out Dave's work. The new comic book that they put out, the Great Race, that one was fun. I loved it. I thought that it did a good job of capturing some of Dave's spirit. Going forward, for the fans of The Rocketeer, maybe this conversation is the first time people said, hey, I should check this stuff out. And maybe they're discovering The Rocketeer and investing in that world now. Where does it go? You know, without Dave here, is there a chance that somebody could reinvest in a Rocketeer film? There's been talk and rumors of a Rocketeer remake or new film for a long time. Are there future possibilities for comic book releases of new stories? Is there a team from maybe some of your interview subjects, cast members from the documentary, that would be the perfect people to entrust with that kind of stuff going forward?
It's a tough question, because most of the time when people do Rocketeer stories, or have done them since Dave passed away, you know, they've been sort of like been mostly tributes or homages or approached with that in mind, because there is that reverence. But I think in order for it to carry on beyond that for long term, you know, you're hoping that someone probably younger will come along and take the reins and kind of forge new ground. That's what I think probably needs to happen in order for it to gain like a new life beyond like something that's like a pure reboot. You know what I mean? Where you just do the same thing again. My own theory, and I've had some ideas myself about this in terms of a pitch, is that as I said before, the period aspect of The Rocketeer. That if you wanted to do another Rocketeer, a great idea would be to move forward in time a little bit to a different, distinctive visual time period, an era, if you will, 60s, you know, or 80s, and infuse it with that. And you know, that to me is the way to have it go forward and you know, breathe life into it is by taking the enthusiasm that somebody else has for a different era that Dave had for the 30s and trying to craft a new story around that. I think that could be a really successful thing. And you could, there's a lot of things you could play with now in terms of gender and, you know, the identity of the characters. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do, but it would take someone with the dedication, you know, because you're going to have to approach it like Dave. I mean, Stephen Mooney did a great job with The Great Race. You know, he wrote it, he drew it, he, you know, tried to infuse all the nostalgic stuff and bridge, you know, between Dave's work and his work, because it'd been a bit of a gap between the previous story from IDW. They made a lot of efforts, but it is difficult to find somebody to do this type of illustrative artwork in comic books now. So that's sort of how I feel about it. I think it's definitely, there's the potential there, but you know, it's a tricky thing, you know, following in footsteps like this, you know.
It might seem sacrilegious, but I worry that moving the character too far beyond the 30s, and obviously The Great Race had dealt with Nazis. We love punching Nazis. And so that started hinting towards the character existing in some form of the 40s. Ultimately, the design of the character is such an incredible part, the visual. I mean, he looks like a hood ornament off of one of those 1930s cars. And would reinterpreting that character into the 60s, maybe aging Cliff Secord into the 60s, it seems like they're doing that with Indiana Jones in the next installment on the big screen. Does that necessitate a change in this iconic look, which is so much of the appeal of the Rocketeer? Not that it's the entire substance of the character. The 60s and the 80s had different looks. does that mean the helmet changes, the character changes?
Well, I mean, Dave loves, you know, cars from the 50s and 60s and the hot rodding stuff. You know, I mean, what year was American Graffiti, Rob? Do you remember what year that was?
Produced in 72, set in 63.
So, you know, he loved that era too, which is technically beyond the Rocketeer. And I think Dave could have just as easily designed something using his love of that period. I think, like I said, it will require an artist who really loves and gets the aesthetic of whatever period it is. And I'm sure that there are people who would disagree with moving the character. And I'm sure you could do another adventure, like a, you know, a finite adventure in the 30s, you know, but I'm looking at it more from a, like, you know what I mean? Like 30 years from now, how does it persevere the way, I mean, Batman or Superman has? Those characters have changed in their appearance and the aesthetic, you know, as time has moved on. I mean, they've tried to keep up with the, you know, with the contemporary time because they're not supposed to be period heroes. But I do think, you know, I do think that someone could do something really great, you know, with this approach. But you'd have to be probably as committed to Dave to really make it work. You know, no half measures, right? No half measures on that.
No, it has committed to be the entire world.
Sense of the word.
Does Hollywood have to lead the way on some of that?
Go ahead, Rob. Go ahead.
The movies are still going to be the most forward, or a TV show will still get the most eyeballs to any character or any property. And if that's something that comes to pass near future, I think that's fantastic. I'll certainly be there on day one to watch and support it. But the Rocketeer's origins are in print, and I think there's more opportunity in that realm, in that medium, than in film, at least at this point. Calvin may know more.
Certainly, I think, you know, IDW is very enthusiastic. They've been great sort of standard bearers for Dave and Scott Dunbier in particular. That's why they're there. When Dave passed away, I and another good friend of Dave Stevens, Dave Mandel, who's a well-known comic art collector and a, you know, television and film writer producer, we sort of helped the family, you know, navigate, you know, what to do about the estate and whatnot. So, and we were very lucky to be able to find a place to take all the print stuff and have it done right, you know. So I'm sure they're always looking. Scott's always looking for somebody, you know. But Rob's right, you know. I mean, these days, like TV and film are where the eyeballs are. I mean, obviously, if someone could do a streaming Rocketeer series, that would be wonders for the exposure. But you know, in terms of trying to experiment and work out like what the next version should be, you know, as a playground, as a sandbox, I think comics is probably the way to go, and somebody can really, you know, try and stretch, I think, you know, in that situation without it being millions of dollars, you know. And just like Dave, they can, you know, be their own director on that page, you know, and make something their own. I think that's really what it is. It's like someone's going to have to, you know, I mean, you know, the Tim Burton did an incredible Batman, you know, but it was still made by Bob Kane, but someone took it and, you know, put their stamp on it, you know. You know, Christopher Nolan too. You know that, you know, it is possible for multiple people to take a character and put their imprint on it and still retain the essence of what made it great and so appealing in the first place.
And I think Rob is right, because both those directors will tell you that Tim Burton was influenced by Arkham Asylum, and you know, clearly those directors were influenced by, you know, Dark Knight Returns and those big publications. Those were real turning points in defining Batman, even in the late, you know, the later stages of Batman. And you're right. Somebody would have, like a Frank Miller type, would have to have a signature take in order to define the character and sort of reintroduce it to a new era of fans. IDW does have that TV department. And, you know, I know that they're busy in looking for opportunities. I mean, I think a streaming show would be amazing, but without the bedrock of new content. I mean, you see how much Marvel is leaning on their old, you know, on their comic book stories for the storylines in their films, you know, then maybe things are straying a little too much from the source. You know, this is still very much a comic book character. Well, guys, it's been amazing talking to you. And I know Shane O'Hare is listening and he's happy. He wanted me, I said, hey, you have any questions for these guys? And he said, I have one factoid, which is that the Zeppelin explosion in Joe Johnston's Rocketeer film at the time was the most single most expensive VFX shot ever in Hollywood. And that the person, and I'm going to read this text, Geekscapist, real quick, because I want to get this right as far as Shane's words are concerned. he says, the only wild trivia that I know about the movie, which I don't know how you'd incorporate it. Well, I'm incorporating it now. He says, the guy who directed the Zeppelin model explosion, maybe the VFX designer, his dad was on the Hindenburg.
Wow.
Yeah, so maybe I've got a couple connections to Joe Johnston. Maybe it's time I have Joe Johnston on the show and say, Joe, can you talk to us about making the Rocketeer movie? Then I'm going to, of course, ask him a bunch of movies about questions about Boba Fett and Jurassic Park 3 and Captain America: First Avenger.
No, Joe was great. He went on and on. We talked to him about the animated sequence, the propaganda film, and he. Joe was really great. He was really generous with his time, and I think he stayed for a little longer than he thought did. He was going to. But you know,
one of the things we actually had to cut was Joe talking about filming his little cameo with Dave. But Dave and Joe were both in the German flashback film.
Yeah, you see a still of it in the documentary. Yeah.
Right, I saw the test pilot scene.
Yeah. I saw the still in the documentary. I said, wait, what the heck is that? Because it's both Joe Johnston and Dave in costume. And there it is. I mean, if y'all love the Boba Fett, who Joe Johnston reportedly was on set of Return of the Jedi, you know, he had a hand in Boba Fett. I mean,
Joe designed Boba Fett. I think he
designed Boba Fett. And I just thought it was so appropriate that Joe Johnston directed the Rocketeer movie, because the Rocketeer design and the Boba Fett design have similar DNA, right? And Joe Johnston designed one, and
they definitely had the same aesthetic. Dave and Joe shared that in common. I mean, Joe also designed the Iron Giant. I don't know if you knew that. You know,
that's incredible.
So that sort of retro, he really did love that time period. So.
You're starting to talk me out of any time leap for this character because that aesthetic is so awesome and so much fun. And so is your documentary, guys. And I want to really thank you for coming on Geekscape. This is awesome. Come back anytime.
Thank you, Jonathan. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us. I really appreciate
having us and spreading the word about our film.
Of course. Rob, you said this is your first interview.
My first interview.
Yeah. How was it? Was it okay?
Best interview ever.
Is that true, right, Kelvin?
This is the first thing we've done for this, I think, other than maybe answering some questions through email or something like that.
Incredible. So. Well, I really appreciate y'all taking the time, and we'll see you in July, and we'll keep promoting Geekscapist. Again, if this is hitting your feed right off the bat, thank you for making Geekscape your first listen of the day. Hop on that Kickstarter, all right, folks, because it is going fast and we don't know how many copies you're going to make. So you get to dictate that. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks so much, John.
Wow, how great was that conversation? I want to thank Kelvin and Rob for taking the time to talk to me about Dave Stevens, the Rocketeer, and pop culture. If you're listening to this episode after December 2nd, well, go order Dave Stevens Drawn to Perfection on digital and on demand. If you happen to be listening to this on the day of release, maybe you have a chance to go to that Kickstarter and donate. You can get the comic book that we talked about in the episode, the Blu-ray. I, of course, want to reach out to Kelvin and invite him and Rob to the Geekscape booth at Comic-Con next summer. There's a ton of stuff coming up in the future, including in the immediate future. There's a lot of content that's going to be coming from LA Comic-Con this weekend. Let me pull up the schedule, but I've got a podcast creation panel on Saturday, along with a conversation with Steve Burns, who is the host of Blue's Clues, and also talking about childhoods and people who raised us. Our good friend LeVar Burton is another conversation I'm having on Saturday at LA Comic Con. I'm going to try and record those and put them on the feed in the near future. And then on Sunday, We have some amazing ones. I'm talking to Amy Jo Johnson from the Power Rangers on the main stage. I'm going to try and record that as well. And I'm following that all up with a big LACC wrap-up Geekscape Live. I'm going to invite some of the people from the network to be a part of it. It's going to be a bit of a party. I really don't know what's going to happen. I just know that we're going to wrap up LA Comic Con and hope to, if you can't make the convention, bring you there in spirit, and you'll hear of our adventures and experiences. So that'll be fun. And of course, there's tons of Geekscape coming down the pipe. We have that big fundraiser coming up on the 9th for Big Brothers Big Sisters. You can donate now on the link. We have it out on our social media right now on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram. Go to the Geekscape Forever Instagram page. You can definitely find it right there in the links in the bio. There's just a lot that we're getting involved in, and we're always having fun. Shane O'Hare, who we mentioned a lot on the episode, texted me and said, "Hey, man, you need to take a break." Well, I will. I mean, I'm going to Thailand for my honeymoon. I'm very much looking forward to that. But there's a lot of content that I'm scheduling on this feed. So if you're enjoying what you're listening to, share this with your friends. Hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Leave us a 5-star review. Do all those things that really help us out, help out our visibility. All right? Because we do this for you for free. And all we ask is that you spread the love and the excitement and say hello when you see us down the road. All right, Geekscapists. We'll see you at LA Comic Con.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.